This is the beginning of Chapter 5, Knowledge of Higher Worlds, Initiation, from the book An Outline of Esoteric Science by Rudolf Steiner. Between birth and death, human beings at our present stage of evolution experience three states of consciousness during ordinary life: waking, sleeping, and the state between them, dreaming. Dreaming will be considered briefly later on in this book, but here let's look at life in its two main alternating states, waking and sleeping. We achieve knowledge of higher worlds by acquiring a third state in addition to sleeping and waking. When we are awake, our souls are devoted to sensory impressions and the mental images they stimulate. When we sleep, these sensory impressions are silenced, but our souls also lose consciousness. The experiences of the day sink down into a sea of unconsciousness. Now, let's imagine that the sleeping soul is capable of becoming conscious in spite of the fact that all sensory perceptions are excluded, as is otherwise the case in deep sleep, and that not even a memory of the day's experiences is present. In that case, would the soul find itself in a state of nothingness? Could it be unable to have any experiences at all? It is only possible to answer these questions if we can actually induce a state of consciousness similar to this, if the soul is actually able to experience something even in the total absence of current and remembered sensory impressions. In this case, although the soul would seem asleep with regard to the ordinary outer world, it would not be asleep, but would confront a real world, just as it does in the waking state. Now, this state of consciousness can be induced if we bring about the soul experiences made possible by spiritual science. Everything spiritual science tells us about the worlds lying beyond the world of the senses, including the information given in preceding chapters of this book, has been investigated by means of this state of consciousness. This chapter will discuss, to the extent possible in this book, the methods used to create the state of consciousness needed for this research. This state of consciousness is similar to sleep in only one respect, namely that it puts an end to all outer sense impressions and eliminates all the thoughts stimulated by these impressions. But although, during sleep, the soul does not have the strength to experience anything consciously, this other state of consciousness provides this strength, awakening a perceptive ability that only sensory impressions can arouse during our ordinary life. The soul's awakening to this higher state of consciousness can be called initiation. Initiation methods lead us out of our usual state of waking consciousness into a soul activity that makes use of spiritual instruments of observation. These instruments are already present in the soul in a seminal state, but they need to be developed. Now, it's possible for people to discover at a certain point in the course of their lives that these higher instruments have developed spontaneously, without any special preparation, and that a certain involuntary self-awakening has taken place. As a result, these people find that their essential nature is totally transformed, and that their soul experiences are infinitely enriched. They also find that no knowledge of the sensory world can possibly provide the bliss, the soul satisfaction and inner warmth that they now experience as a result of what is being disclosed to understanding that is not accessible to the physical eye, EYE. Strength and certainty will flow into their will from a spiritual world. Such instances of self-initiation do occur, but they should not tempt us to believe that the only right thing to do is to wait for this to happen and do nothing to bring initiation about through appropriate training. Since self-initiation can come about without observing rules of any sort, it is not necessary to talk about it here, but what will be described is how training can develop the seminal organs of perception lying dormant in the soul. People who feel no particular urge to do something for the sake of their own development may easily say that human life stands under the guidance of spiritual powers, and that instead of intervening in this guidance, we should patiently await the moment when these powers find it right to disclose another world to our souls. These people may well feel that there is a certain presumptuousness or unjustified desire in wanting to interfere with wise spiritual guidance. People who think like this will change their minds only when one particular thought makes a strong impression on them. This thought is, quote, "This wise guidance has given me certain faculties, not so that they will remain unused, but so that I can put them to use. The wisdom in this guidance lies in the fact that it has planted the seeds of a higher state of consciousness in me. I understand this guidance only if I feel that human beings have an obligation to reveal everything their own spiritual powers can possibly reveal." Unquote. If this thought has made a strong enough impression on the soul, then the above-mentioned doubts about training for a higher state of consciousness will disappear. However, another doubt can still arise about this training. We might say, quote, "Developing inner soul faculties constitutes an intervention in an individual's hidden holiest of holies, and involves a certain transformation of that person's entire nature. It is inherently impossible for us to independently conceive of the means for bringing about such a transformation, because only those who have personally experienced reaching a higher world can know how to do it." But if we turn to a person like this, we permit that person to have an influence on our own soul's hidden holiest of holies. Unquote. Even having methods for bringing about a higher state of consciousness presented in book form would not be particularly reassuring to people who think like this, because the point is not whether we receive this information as an oral communication or learn about these methods from someone who knows about them and presents them in a book. There are indeed people who are knowledgeable about the rules for developing spiritual organs of perception, but subscribe to the view that these rules should not be entrusted to a book. In general, these people also consider it impermissible to communicate certain truths having to do with the spiritual world. Given the present stage of humankind's evolution, however, this view must be considered outdated in a certain way. It is true that we can go only so far in communicating the rules in question, but the information that can be provided leads far enough so that those who apply it to their own souls will reach a point in the development of their knowledge where they will then be able to discover the rest of the way. Only personal previous experience on the path to spiritual knowledge can give us the right idea about how this path then leads on. All these facts can give rise to doubts about the path to spiritual knowledge, but these doubts disappear when we consider the nature of the course of development indicated by the training that is appropriate to our times. This is the path that will be discussed here. Other methods of training will be mentioned only briefly. The training that will be discussed here will provide those who have the will to develop their higher faculties with the means for beginning to transform their souls. There is no question of dubious intervention in the student's inner nature unless the teacher attempts to bring about this transformation through methods that elude the student's consciousness, and no instruction in spiritual development that is appropriate for our times makes use of methods like that. Appropriate instruction does not make the student into an unconscious instrument. It supplies rules of conduct which the student then implements. When the occasion arises, the reason for laying down some particular rule will not be withheld. People searching for spiritual development do not need to receive and apply these rules as a matter of blind faith. In fact, blind faith is totally out of place in this area. If we have not yet begun spiritual training ourselves, but have considered the nature of the human soul simply as it reveals itself to our ordinary self-observation, we can ask ourselves, after receiving the recommended rules of spiritual training, how can these rules affect our soul life? Even without any training, we can answer this question adequately by applying our healthy common sense in an unbiased way. We can get the right idea of how these rules work even before we subject ourselves to them, although only training itself allows us to actually experience how they work. Even then, our experience will always be accompanied by understanding only if sound judgment accompanies each step we take. In this day and age, any true science of the spirit will provide only rules that can stand up to the scrutiny of sound judgment. If we are ready and willing to undertake only this kind of training, and do not permit any bias to drive us into blind faith, all our doubts will disappear. We will not be disturbed by any objections that can be raised about an appropriate training in attaining a higher state of consciousness. This training is not superfluous, even for those whose inner maturity can eventually lead to self-awakening of their spiritual organs of perception. On the contrary, it is especially suitable for them, because people like this almost invariably have to make many roundabout, useless detours before self-initiation takes place. Training spares them these detours and leads them forward on a straight path. Self-initiation is a result of having achieved the appropriate degree of maturity during preceding lifetimes. It can very easily happen that a soul rejects training out of a certain dim sense of its own maturity, since this feeling can create a certain arrogance that prevents the person from having confidence in a true spiritual training. It is also possible for a certain level of soul development to remain concealed and appear only at a certain age. In such cases, training can be exactly the right way to make it appear. But if the person in question remains closed to the possibility of training, it may well be that his or her ability will remain concealed during the present lifetime and will appear again only during some subsequent life. It is important to avoid certain obvious misunderstandings with regard to the training in supersensible knowledge that is intended here. One such misunderstanding can arise from thinking that this training intends to make its students into different beings with regard to how they lead their entire lives. But this is not a question of giving people general instructions on how to conduct their lives. It's a question of telling them about soul practices they can carry out in order to learn to observe the supersensible element. These practices have no direct influence on the parts of their lives that lie outside of supersensible observation. People acquire the gift of supersensible observation in addition to these other parts of their lives. This perceptive activity is just as separate from life's ordinary functions as the waking state is from sleep. One state cannot interfere with the other in the least. Wanting to have impressions of the supersensible interspersed in the course of life's ordinary events would be like dealing with constant unhealthy interruptions to your sleep when you are ill. The student must be able to induce the state of observing supersensible reality through an act of free will. Indirectly, however, supersensible training is related to certain standards of conduct, inasmuch as insight into the supersensible is either impossible or harmful without a certain ethical attitude toward life. For this reason, much of what leads to supersensible observation is also a means of ennobling how we lead our lives. On the other hand, insight into the supersensible world allows us to recognize higher moral impulses that also apply to the physical world of the senses. Certain moral necessities can only be recognized from the supersensible world. A second misunderstanding consists in believing that soul practices leading to supersensible cognition might involve changes in the physical body's structure or functioning. On the contrary, these practices have nothing at all to do with anything that is any business of physiologies or of any other branch of natural science, for that matter. They are purely spiritual soul processes that are as far removed from anything physical as healthy thinking and perception are. What happens in the soul as a result of such practices is no different in character from what happens during healthy thinking or conclusion forming. The processes involved in a real training in supersensible knowledge have just as much or little to do with the body as healthy thinking does, and anything that relates to the human being in any other way is a distortion of true spiritual training rather than the real thing. The presentation that follows is to be taken in the spirit of what has been said here. If supersensible training seems to require things that would make a person into something else, this is simply because supersensible cognition proceeds from a person's entire soul. In actual fact, it is simply a question of instruction in practices that make it possible for the soul to bring about moments in its life when it can observe the supersensible. It is only possible to rise to a state of supersensible consciousness from ordinary waking consciousness, the state the soul lives in prior to its ascent. Training provides the soul with methods that will lead it out of the ordinary waking state. Among the first methods provided by the training we are discussing here are some that can still be described as functions of ordinary waking consciousness. The most important of these consist of silent activities of the soul. The soul is meant to devote itself to certain specific mental images that have the intrinsic power to awaken certain hidden faculties in the human soul. Such mental images are different from those of our daily waking life, whose purpose is to depict outer things. The more truly they do this, the truer they themselves are, and it is part of their essential nature to be true in this sense. This is not the purpose of the mental images the soul concentrates on when its goal is spiritual training. These images are not structured so as to reproduce anything external, but to have an awakening effect on the soul. The best thought pictures for this purpose are symbolic ones, but others can be used also. The content of these mental images is not the point. The point is that the soul devotes all its energies to having nothing in its consciousness other than the mental image in question. In our everyday soul life, the soul's energies are divided among many different things, and our mental images shift rapidly. In spiritual training, however, the point is to concentrate the soul's entire activity on a single mental image that is freely chosen as a focus for consciousness. For this reason, symbolic images are better than ones that represent outer objects or processes and have a point of contact with the outer world, since these do not force the soul to rely on itself to the same extent as it does with symbols that it creates out of its own energy. It's not important what is imagined, but only that the process of visualizing the image frees the soul from dependence on anything physical. By calling to mind the concept of memory, we can begin to grasp what it means to immerse ourselves in a visualized image. For example, if we look at a tree and then turn away from it so that we can no longer see it, we can reawaken the mental image of the tree out of our memory. The mental image we have of a tree when it is not actually present before our eyes is the memory of the tree. Now let's imagine that we retain this memory in our soul. We allow the soul to rest on this memory image and attempt to exclude all other images. Then the soul is immersed in the memory image of the tree. But although the soul is immersed in a mental image, this image is a copy of something perceived by our senses. However, if we attempt the same thing with an image that we insert into our consciousness through an act of free will, we will gradually be able to achieve the necessary effect. We will illustrate this with a single example of contemplating or meditating on a symbolic mental image. First, this mental image must be built up in the soul. I can do this as follows. I imagine a plant taking root in the ground, sprouting one leaf after another, and continuing to develop up to the point of flowering. Then I imagine a human being alongside this plant. In my soul, I bring to life the thought that this human being has qualities and abilities that can be called more perfect than those of the plant. I think about how human beings are able to move around in response to their feelings and intentions, while plants are attached to the ground. But then, I also notice that although human beings are certainly more perfect than plants, they also have characteristics that we cannot perceive in plants, characteristics whose absence can actually make plants seem more perfect than humans. Human beings are filled with desires and passions which their actions obey, and certain errors result from these drives and passions. In contrast, I see how plants obey the pure laws of growth. As they develop one leaf after another and open their flowers without passion to the chaste rays of the sun, I can say that human beings have an advantage over plants with regard to a certain type of perfection, but that the price they have paid for this perfection is to allow urges, desires, and passions to enter their nature alongside the forces of the plants that seem so pure to me. Next, I visualize the green sap flowing through the plant and imagine this as an expression of the pure, passionless laws of growth. Then I visualize the red blood flowing through human arteries and imagine it as an expression of urges, desires, and passions. I allow all this to arise in my soul as a vivid thought. Then I think about how human beings are capable of development, how they can use the higher soul faculties to cleanse and purify their urges and passions. I think about how this destroys a baser element in these urges and passions, which are then reborn on a higher level. The blood may then be imagined as the expression of these cleansed and purified urges and passions. For example, in the spirit, I see a rose and say, in the red sap of the rose blossom, I see the color of the plant's green sap transformed into red, and the red rose, like the green leaf, obeys the pure, passionless laws of growth. Let the red of the rose symbolize the blood that is an expression of purified urges and passions. They have been stripped of their baser element and are now similar in purity to the forces that are active in the red rose. I now try not only to assimilate these thoughts with my intellect, but also to bring them to life in my feeling. I can have a blissful sensation when I imagine the growing plant's purity and absence of passion. I can generate a feeling in myself for the price human beings must pay for greater perfection by acquiring urges and desires. This can transform my earlier bliss into a serious feeling. Next, a feeling of liberating happiness can stir in me as I devote myself to the thought of the red blood that can become the vehicle of inwardly pure experiences, just like the red sap of the rose blossom. It is important not to unfeelingly confront the thoughts that serve to build up a symbolic mental image such as this. After having basked in these thoughts and feelings, we transform them into this symbolic image. We imagine a black cross. Let this be the symbol of the baser element that has been eliminated from our urges and passions. We imagine seven radiant red roses arranged in a circle, where the two beams of the cross intersect. Let these be the symbol of the blood that is an expression of cleansed, purified passions and urges. Footnote. The point here is not the extent to which any particular natural scientific view can or cannot find these thoughts justifiable. The point is to develop thoughts about plants and human beings that can be acquired by means of simple direct observation without any theory whatsoever. These thoughts do have a value alongside other more theoretical ideas, parenthesis, which are no less valuable in other respects, parenthesis, about things in the outer world. In this case, the purpose of these thoughts is not to present facts in a scientific way, but to build up a symbol that proves effective on a soul level, regardless of whatever objections may occur to one or the other individual as it is being built up. Rudolf Steiner, footnote, end of footnote. This symbolic image must now be called up before our mind's eye in the way described earlier with regard to a memory image. A symbolic mental image such as this has the power to awaken our souls when we inwardly immerse ourselves in it and devote ourselves to it. We must try to exclude all other mental images while we are immersed in this one. We must allow only this symbol to linger before our mind's eye in the spirit, and it must be as vivid as possible. It is not without significance that this symbol was not immediately proffered as a soul-awakening image, but was first built up by means of specific ideas about plants and human beings, because the effectiveness of a symbol like this depends on its being put together in this way before it is used for meditation. If we imagine it without first having gone through this build-up in our own souls, the symbol remains cold and is much less effective than if it has received its soul-illuminating power through this preparation. During meditation, however, we should not summon up all of these preparatory thoughts, but should only allow the image to linger vividly before us in the spirit, while permitting the feeling we had as a result of these preparatory thoughts to resonate. In this way, the symbol becomes a token of this experience of feeling, and its effectiveness is due to the fact that the soul dwells on this experience. The longer we can dwell on it without a different and disruptive image intervening, the more effective the whole process will be. However, outside of the time we set aside for actual meditation, it is a good idea to frequently repeat the process of building up the image through thoughts and feelings of the type described above, so that the feeling doesn't fade away. The more patience we have in renewing it, the more significant the image becomes for our souls. Parenthesis: additional examples of methods of meditation are described in my book, How to Know Higher Worlds. Described there are meditations on becoming and dying in plants, the creative forces lying dormant in seeds, the forms of crystals, and so on, which are especially effective. The intent here was to use a single example to demonstrate the nature of meditation. Parenthesis. A symbol, such as the one described here, is not a copy of any outer thing or being that nature has produced. But this very fact gives it the power to awaken certain faculties that are strictly soul-like in character. However, an objection could be raised to this. Someone might say, quote, "It's true that the symbol as a whole is not present in nature, but all its details have been borrowed from nature, the black color, the roses, and so on. All these things are perceived by the senses." Unquote. Anyone who is bothered by this objection should consider the fact that the process of reproducing the sense perceptions is not what leads to awakening our higher soul faculties, but that this is brought about solely through how these details are combined, and the combination itself does not depict anything that is present in the world of the senses. This symbol was intended to illustrate the process of effective meditation. In spiritual training, any number of images of this sort could be used, and they could be built up in many different ways. Certain sentences, phrases, or single words may also be assigned as subjects for meditation. The goal of all these methods of meditation, however, is to tear the soul away from sensory perception and to rouse it to activity in which physical sense impressions are meaningless, and the development of dormant inner soul faculties becomes the essential thing. It is also possible to meditate only on feelings, sensations, and so on, and such meditations prove to be especially effective. Let's take the feeling of joy, for example. In the normal course of our lives, our souls may experience joy when an outer stimulus for it is present. A soul with healthy feelings, who sees a person doing something out of the goodness of his or her heart, will experience satisfaction and joy. But this soul can then proceed to think about an action of this sort, saying, quote, When something is done out of the goodness of someone's heart, the person in question is acting not in his or her own interest, but in the interest of fellow human beings. Such an action may be called morally good." Unquote. The meditating soul, however, can free itself completely from its mental image of the individual case in the outer world that has given it joy or satisfaction, and it can then form a comprehensive idea of good-heartedness. Perhaps it thinks of how good-heartedness comes about when one's soul absorbs another's interest and makes it its own. The meditating soul can then feel joy in this moral idea of good-heartedness. This joy is not due to any process in the sensory world. It is joy in an idea as such. If we attempt to keep such joy alive in the soul for a certain length of time, we are meditating on a feeling, a sensation. What then becomes effective in arousing our inner soul faculties is not the idea itself, but rather the ongoing influence of a feeling within the soul that has not been stimulated by a mere individual outer impression. Since supersensible knowledge is able to delve more deeply into the essence of things than our ordinary thinking, meditating on feelings derived from supersensible experience is much more effective in developing soul faculties. As necessary as this may be for higher levels of training, we must be aware that we can go quite far simply through energetic meditation on feelings and sensations of the sort typified by the meditation on good-heartedness. Since people differ in their essential character, different training methods will be effective for different individuals. With regard to how long meditation should last, we must keep in mind that the calmer and more deliberate this meditation can become, the stronger its effect will be. However, any excesses in this direction should be avoided. The exercises themselves teach us a certain inner discretion and can show us the limits to observe in this regard. As a rule, such meditation exercises will have to be carried out for a long time before the person doing them is able to perceive their results. Patience and persistence are absolute prerequisites of spiritual training. People who do not summon up both of these attitudes, who do not calmly continue to do their exercises with patience and persistence, forming a constant underlying mood in their souls, will not accomplish much. It should have become evident by now that meditation is a means of acquiring knowledge about higher worlds. However, it should also be evident that not just any arbitrary thought content will lead to this knowledge, but only one that has been organized as described. The path that is pointed out here leads first to what can be called imaginative cognition, which is the first stage of higher knowledge. Cognition based on sensory perceptions and their assimilation by the sense-bound intellect can be called object cognition in the sense of spiritual science. Beyond this lie higher levels of cognition, the first of which is imaginative cognition. The term imaginative may cause doubts on the part of those who think of imagination only in terms of illusory ideas that don't correspond to anything real. In spiritual science, however, imaginative cognition must be understood as cognition that comes about through a supersensible state of consciousness in the soul. Our senses have no access to the spiritual realities and beings that are perceived in this state. Because this state of consciousness is awakened in the soul by meditating on symbols or imaginations, the world belonging to this higher state of consciousness can be called the imaginative world, and the cognition that applies to it can be called imaginative cognition. Therefore, imaginative means something that is real in a different sense than the realities and beings of sensory physical perception. The content of the mental images that fill our imaginative experience is not important at all. What is important is the soul faculty that this experience develops. One very natural objection to using the symbolic images described here is that they are shaped by dreamlike thinking and arbitrary imagination, and can therefore only have dubious results. Doubts of this sort are unjustified with regard to the particular symbols that form the basis of genuine spiritual training, because these symbols are chosen in such a way that it is entirely possible to disregard their connection to any outer sensory reality, and to seek their value only in the force they exert on the soul, when it withdraws all of its attention from the outer world, suppresses all sensory impressions, and excludes all thoughts it might entertain as a result of external stimulation. The meditative state is best illustrated by comparing it to the sleeping state. These two states are similar to one respect. These two states are similar in one respect, and totally opposite in another. Meditation is sleep that constitutes a higher form of wakefulness in comparison to our ordinary consciousness during the day. The important point is that concentrating on the idea or image in question forces the soul to summon up much stronger forces from its own depths than it does in ordinary life or ordinary cognition. This increases its inner liveliness. It frees itself from the body, just as it does during sleep, but without falling into a state of unconsciousness. Instead, it experiences a world it did not experience before. Although this soul state is similar to sleep, in that the soul is released from the body, in comparison to ordinary day consciousness, it can be described as a state of heightened wakefulness. This allows the soul to experience itself in its true inner independent nature. In contrast, because the soul's own forces do not develop to the same extent in the ordinary daily waking state, it can only become conscious of itself there with the help of the body. As a result, it does not experience itself, but only becomes aware of itself in the reflection-like image that the body, or actually the body's processes, presents to it. By their very nature, symbols built up in the way described above do not yet relate to anything real in the spiritual world. They serve to free the human soul from sensory perception and from the brain, the instrument to which our intellect is initially bound. This cannot happen before we feel that we are imagining something by means of forces that do not use the brain and the senses as their tools. The first thing we experience on this path is this process of being freed from our physical organs. We can then say that our consciousness is not extinguished when we disregard sensory perceptions and ordinary intellectual thinking. We are able to rise above them and experience ourselves as individual beings alongside what we were previously. This is the first purely spiritual experience, observing an I-being of soul and spirit, a new self that has risen up out of the self that is bound only to the physical senses and the physical intellect. If we freed ourselves from the world of the senses and the intellect without meditation, we would sink down into the nothingness of unconsciousness. Of course, we each have a being of soul and spirit prior to meditation, but at that point it has no tools for observing the spiritual world. It is something similar to a physical body without eyes for seeing or ears for hearing. The energy applied during meditation first creates organs of soul and spirit in a previously unorganized soul-spiritual being. What is created in this way is also the first thing we perceive. So in a certain sense, our first experience is a self-perception. It belongs to the very nature of spiritual training that at this point in its development, the soul practicing self-education is fully conscious of the fact that it first perceives itself in the world of images, imaginations, that appears as a result of the exercises that have been described. Although these images appear to be living in a new world, the soul must recognize that to begin with, they are nothing more than a reflection of its own being, strengthened by these exercises. Not only must the soul recognize this and assess the situation correctly, it must also have developed its will sufficiently to be able to remove or extinguish these images from consciousness at any time. Within these images, the soul must be able to act freely and completely deliberately. This belongs to a genuine spiritual training at this point. If the soul were not able to do this, its situation in the domain of spiritual experience would be similar to that of a soul in the physical world if its eyes were fixated on objects and unable to look away. There is only one exception to the rule that it must be possible to extinguish images, and that is a group of inner pictorial experiences that must not be extinguished at this stage of spiritual training. They correspond to the core of the soul's own being. In these images, each student of the spirit recognizes his or her fundamental being, the aspect of the self that moves through repeated earth lives. At this point, sensing repeated earth lives becomes a real experience. In all other instances, however, the above-mentioned independence with regard to spiritual experiences must prevail. Only after having acquired the ability to extinguish our experiences do we approach the real spiritual world outside of ourselves. In place of what we have extinguished, something else appears, and we recognize its spiritual reality. We feel that our souls are outgrowing something undefined and becoming something defined. We must then move on from self-perception to observing an outer world of soul and spirit. This happens when we structure our inner experience along the lines of what will be described next. The end of the first part of chapter 5. I have finished paragraph 17 on page 302 of An Outline of Esoteric Science.